to the Mug Meeting Summaries podcast. I'm Gilbert Detilieu. Our June meeting started with the usual roundtable discussion, moderated by Doug Shufelt. Topics covered included Python 2 versus 3, headless server configurations, anti-spam and antivirus appliances, and unified threat management appliances, and spam address harvesting techniques and spam blocking techniques.
So I'll get us started. I think this talk was decided on multiple months ago, but I think security has gotten even more prominence in news coverage lately, and including people got fooled that our Prime Minister was dead. So if anyone has any insight on any insights to share on any of the famous attacks that happened lately, I'll sort of prompt for that as we study those situations.
I didn't do it.
When did Krechnia die?
When did Krechnia die?
Isn't he the president?
I think he may have been
president?
Prime minister. Our moderator.
Yeah, that's what it's called. Prime minister.
Well, it seems that spear phishing is pretty popular as a technique to get a password.
Sorry, what's that called?
Spear phishing. Yeah. It's when you pretend you're someone who's an authority figure above the person, and tell your underling, give me your password. And the underling says, yes, sir. And so it's a form of phishing from above. Spear phishing. It's a great term. But apparently it's been pretty effective as a social technique.
Social engineering has been quite effective since approximately the days of
ever.
So it's no surprise that it should continue to be effective today. And spear phishing is just a semi-automated implementation of social engineering, as is phishing in general, really.
Wasn't Adam and Eve a social engineering attack?
Well, you know, the apple, it's just a fruit, right? There's nothing wrong with eating this. Go right ahead and eat it. Honest, trust me, it's safe.
How old are you? Somebody making Alice and Barbara at home. Graham.
We don't know the snake's name.
That's true.
It's Bob.
But there wasn't a problem until the female showed up.
There's
no security issues.
Take that back.
We have a question back there.
Maybe a serious one.
Anyway, I've actually got three things, not necessarily have to be discussed here, but if I could get talking about afterwards. One of them is and the guy over there that just showed up tonight, I'm the next newbiest newbie view, so I'm still picking brains. There's someone who, say, wants to jump into learning Python, the three, or still have enough basic stuff that we're talking about?
Two.
I like it short and sweet. The second thing is if somebody could give me, I've done some research on my own, what I want to do at home network, set up a headless server. I've kind of read up on it, be nice to somebody with their hands dirty. The third thing also I'm looking into, which is, I guess, progressively getting popular, setting up a home entertainment for the internet, but that is also capable of several. I know that's kind of blocking them pretty, but I've been reading and kind of studying on it, and just gets me back to make on my hands dirty. So whatever you can touch now is great. If not, if you can after.
You want to discuss any of those three?
Sure. Well, the first one was taken care of.
I'll explain why. Why sort two? Okay. Why Python 2? Because if you want to do anything interesting, you want to rely not just on the very massive Python standard libraries, but on third-party library as well. And, you know, that even hasn't fully moved along yet. Are they up to 7?
Seven is the latest.
Stuff changes drastically between revisions, though. So.
Yeah, but no Python 2 libraries at work. 5 is great.
But the counter-argument is if you're learning a language from scratch right now, Python 3 is going to be a lot less to effort, particularly if you don't anticipate doing any production programming in it for a number of years, by which point Python 3 will be much more dominant today. Like today, it's still treated as an experimental toy. That is changing rapidly. So there's also a question of your timeline. If you want to do something with it today, then yeah, I agree with everybody else. 2.6 or 2.6 at the absolute early. If you want to learn Python for the sake of learning the Python language, learning how the language is structured and how it works, interesting to three. So it's...
They've also included a lot of the stuff that was add-on modules in Compass series, native 3. So a lot of the workhorse stuff they discovered built into the 2, built the little Pebble.
And kind of related as well, the libraries on Mac, if you replace your existing Python 1 bundled with your operating system, with the newer one, yes, Adam's had experience with this, it breaks very badly.
And you don't want to do that.
So you can install them side by side. But you got to know which you're calling for your...
Maybe as a subset, I'd ask you, because I want to kind of get... what were you...
VI? It's not a really IDE-specific language. You can use idle, which is the built-in command line stuff. Your best bet is to not go the IDE route, because you'll spend most of your time fiddling with the IDE and not the language.
Okay.
Pick up a... There's a book online. It's free. I'm going to destroy the name, but it's like Thinking Like a Computer Scientist, and it's all about having to use Python in a very computer science-y way, you know, graphs and trees and whatnot. It's really nice. Here's how to get things done, and it uses Python as the language. It's pretty slick.
Just a little bit to add to that there. I've been doing some Python development recently, and I'm pretty new to it, too. So I had already used Eclipse for a while for some other stuff, so I tried PyDev, which is a Eclipse plugin for Python. And it is true, there's somewhat of a learning curve more than just plain old text editor, but in my case, at least, I found it to be worth it for the way I work. And it also is great for source control, too. You can get plugins for, like, Mercurial or SVN or whatever you want.
Sorry, interrupt. Can you post the link to that book on the website?
Sure.
A lot of us, I'm sure, would like to.
Somebody should remind me.
I'm going to agree more with Sean than Sam. You should use a plain editor. Just don't use too dumb an editor, because Python is case sensitive. You want an editor that helps you with your animation.
What platform? What machine?
Windows?
Okay.
Yeah. Don't use gedit. It does not help you with your implementation.
By the way, gedit on Windows does, if you set the syntax to Python, unless you do a return statement, it will tab over where you are. Yeah. I learned that this week.
On your second question, your headless server, what OS are you talking about?
Well, so far, like a lot of newbies, I just left my data into what it's basically what I want to use it for is print server or file server.
So how did you envision Axe and headless through another Linux box with SSH?
Yes, that's some of the stuff I read.
Because I've tried that a few times. Everything works just well and good until it boots. And then you have two options. You have to have a serial connection, which can be dicey to get a serial connection working to Linux boxes, wiring it up. But Linux also, you can have it broadcast syslog boot for your over DDD. If you set up something like Netcast and say a laptop to go to the network, have it always broadcast boot message and networks and captures for home users.
Yep.
But at least if it goes haywire, you'll have an idea where it went wrong. But you're still at times going to plug a keyboard in and play with it to try to correct the
problem. Is this a machine that you can just leave a keyboard and monitor connected to, or you have a monitor that
well,
you could connect in a pinch?
Well,
or is it going to be someplace that's inaccessible and there's no chance?
Well, once I get it set up and turn it,
I've done that. Like, I've set up a server. It's not inaccessible. I basically never. It's always booted. Because I just, it's Ubuntu, and I just apply the updates, and it's always booted.
Until this thing, never look at.
Yeah.
It's in a corner, this fails. And then, I've run one of those kind of servers for years. I fortunately have enough room, and I finally gave up, and I strapped an old crappy 4CRT on it to mostly power down and crappy keyboard. It's there when I need it. Other than that, I don't do anything, because all the methods I found to try to communicate regularly never worked when I had pinch anyway. So, make sure you have something to plug into it, at least in the house.
A
monitor and a keyboard, so if things get really, really bad, or somebody can borrow one off quickly, because if you're dependent on it for your firewall, your router, and stuff like that, then it's kind of crippling.
Yeah. There's another big catch to running true headless, like we're plugged in. Thankfully, it's becoming less of an issue with time, but there are a huge number of motherboards will not properly be plugged in.
You're like 99.96% of them?
Well, I wouldn't say it's that high, but yes, it's very large.
Really?
More recent Tyann BIOS will give you the option of booting headless, so it just dumps everything to serial. But those are few and far between. If you're going on the PC side, you have to buy a machine that's headless recommended, as opposed to just taking any old box and pulling a video card out.
Well, I disagree. I've done like 3 dozen machines. I've never once run into one without a monitor plugged in.
No, like with absolutely no video card.
Oh, wow. Well,
okay. Yeah, they all need video cards.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all need
plug nothing into it.
Yeah, because then you can take anything and then set the default TTY to the console, and then you'll get after the bootloader. You won't get anything before that.
What I meant was the first implementation of video cards won't post without a VGA cable or an EDI cable.
Just plug in
them. Oh, wow.
I haven't run into that. Yes, it is. I have quite a collection of cards that behave that way now.
If you do choose to know the serial route, if you want the master past boot up time for the Linux kernel itself, kernel on, you have to add redirect console to the serial device, or you won't be able to see what you normally see on the monitor will not go out serial port once you get past certain phase. We go out of the loader to the turn.
Yeah, but isn't he going to use a machine that has a video card in it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a moot point.
Yeah. Well, it's not. I mean,
it is. He can plug in a monitor. He's already said he's got a monitor to plug
in. It depends on whether he has room for it or not to leave it there. I mean, you can hook up a serial cable and run them quite a distance and put it somewhere else in the upstairs.
But why go to the trouble?
If you never want to go see them.
But you
he never does.
So it's always going to work. To diagnose system problems, you may want to look at logs someday while it's booting to see if something's going wrong.
Yeah, I've got a small pile of headless machines
at
home.
You don't need it all the time.
And I do serial over Cat5 with USB adapters, and it runs fantastically well. But the machines are designed to not have a video card.
Yeah.
That's the key. Because a lot will just go, oh, you don't have a video card, I'm not posting. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a board that's got built-on video, go ahead, do it. Have no problem. Or if you want to be equally lazy like me, just get a VPS. You can get them really, really cheap now.
Yeah.
You can get them free at Amazon. You just pop that up, right? A micro instance?
Yeah, micro is 12 so. Months, basically 600 megs RAM, one processor, and 10 gig traffic are free. So.
Yeah, for a year. I mean,
this
if you're just spooling something up to test.
No space is in your base. No, none of yours.
Is there some advantage to having like a real headless no video? Is it just one less part
less
that
power.
Might not fail, or what's
it's
the real
thing? Less power usage.
Yeah. And some machines lock up when their video card fails. It's on
the
bus, and if it drives the bus, you're screwed. So if you have one with that only has an inserted card, if it's on the motherboard and the BIOS doesn't allow you to save it, you don't need much.
Yeah. Okay.
It's power and physical size footprint. It's a very simplified motherboard. So you've got a processor, you've got your memory, your self bridge, and maybe a PCI slot, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have such a board. If people are interested and want to talk to me at the very about that kind of thing. But yeah, it's priced too, like, fairly awesome.
Yeah, like you can go Socris root, Alex root. There's tons of them out there.
Yeah,
I like the Socris ones personally. That's the ones I got a pile of.
Yeah, I've got PC engines.
And then the Alex PC engines. They're all over the router board.
Yeah.
Even some of the Linksys access points, you can turn them into SBCs as well.
Yeah, then the key if you are doing it, then you need serial as a backup. It's you gotta have it at four levels. You gotta have BIOS having it. You gotta have bootloader having it. You gotta have your kernel having it before init starts Gettys, and you gotta have your Getty.
Reference, although I'm now responsible for all told, probably a couple hundred that don't have consoles of any sort. Dell servers, so they have a physical video board, but we run the dirty head. We run special hardware to make sure that the machine crashes and burns. I can connect to, in the Dell case, the Dell Access Controller, which lets me see what I would see monitor if I had a monitor. It works reasonably well, and all of this competing hardware, any hardware is designed to not run with monitor. Generally, you'll have problems. Provide alternate mechanisms to do the same things you ordinarily need the most to do. But at home, the server, which may as well be headless, I took an old cheap 10.4x68 LCD panel, otherwise desk for the garbage, just sit on top of it. I hardly ever use it about once a year. But the once a year, it generally is because the boot drive died, the RAID controller somehow lost its creation, and something that I need a console. If you can find a monitor somewhere, just hook it up and leave it, assuming you have the space to do so. And leave it powered off, just having it plugged in. If you're only talking one machine, probably have something just for diagnosis.
Yeah, we're going to take a bit of a tangent because at the previous meeting, we were talking virtual. You could always use a virtual machine for your server itself within the physical machine. And just for pure simplicity's sake, there are three server virtual machines out there. Bitnami does a bunch, VMware does a bunch as well. So it's a matter of basically downloading and start up your virtual machines and let it run.
That's
that's a good solution. I mean, I agree. Where I've found that it gets a little tricky is then when you're doing it in file server, because then you got to make a whole bunch of storage, which you can do a whole lot of ways.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're adding that extra layer that you've got to mount storage from somewhere else, or make virtual disk attached to that machine.
But actually, for a file server, the presentation you guys gave a couple of years ago was spot on. At the lab, I've set up a couple of free NAS boxes and never had any problems with them.
Well, and that was the other thing I was going to mention, like, is sort of at the at the next layer, there's, like, you, for the services that you're trying to set up, it's pretty straightforward. You want to roll your own, you could learn that. But there are perfect builds for that. Free NAS that'll do file sharing, DLNA, and printers, so that you can hear it. There's another one that I've been playing with recently called Ahi, which is quite nice. It's headless in the sense that you manage system from a browser from another sheet. You don't ever attach to it. You get use of the disk usage and all that. Along with a whole bunch of other plugin at, I think it was like BitTorrent plugin, podcast plugin, applications that are pre-packaged and download and suck stuff down, get in whatever you want. So it's sort of a, it's not a roll your own solution, but it's a simple way of getting all those services you're talking about, you know, managed distribution. It has sometimes, like, the Amahi service has some nice, like, sets you up a dynamic DNS account and makes the status of your machine available even when you're outside your own private network. You just even go to check. It does a lot of sort of the lower level configurations done ahead of time. Gives you the, you're not going to learn how to get that set up if this is a box count service.
Well, I want to get my.
Does anybody have any experience in Mayo? Spam antivirus. These are front end devices that just set the firewall of the mail and nicely take care of all your spam woes, provide user access for the people in whitelist and stuff like that.
They all suck. Barracuda sucks the least, in my experience.
I would generally agree with that. There's not a single. I've now had to deal with half a dozen or more, at least 7 or 8 different vendors claimed. As a dedicated anti-spam appliance, the Sean Barrett is sucks east, which means that it's only about 5 times it's actually the price. Network-based anti-spam is fundamentally never to be as effective as anti-spam. So if they run, what are you running as a mail server?
Well, in this case, it's at 2010. Exactly. I just worked on the network stuff, and they proposed certain devices. I went out and looked at this device, too poorly rated. Another device, better rated. I saw a mention of Barracuda, but the only reviews I saw that included this one said it was the worst of the lot. Cisco.
Oh, God, no.
I'm not looking at it. I'm looking sideways at
remember,
it.
Remember, nobody ever got fired for buying Cisco.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Well, I'm not buying it either. I just got a coexist thing. It seems like a really bad idea because they're replacing a fairly effective spam control system. We don't have any antivirus. It's all done at host, right? So they're looking at possibly in future adding virus scanning.
If you want all one, like it sounds like you're asking what's called FI Threat Managed Plan, which usually bundles. It bundles IDS, firewall, antivirus, anti-spam.
No, something like Untangle.
yeah, actually, Untangle on the Linux quasi home. I mean, it's a commercial product.
This has got to be enterprise grade.
Then you're. It
can be open source.
Okay, if you need like 24/7 support, your decent option boil down to Barracuda, maybe Fortinet and Fortiman.
We're throwing one of those out.
They're probably the second best. And that gives you.
Man, you're scaring me.
Well, if you're gonna, you can do it MX based. There's a bunch of services online that do it. For Exchange, you've got Exchange hosted services, which you can route all your mail through, and they'll filter it for you. And mailroute.info is another decent one.
Yeah, there may be some over privacy.
Well, it's what you're paying for, right? You pay the $50,000 for the box that maybe will work, or you pay $5,000 a year for a company that does it.
It's a no-brainer for me, but it's not my money and it's not my decision.
That's how I would explain it if I was in the room. I'd say these two things here are the facts.
That hasn't worked. It's like help them pick the lesser of evils about the point of my role now. So.
If they want a box sitting in a rack, the filtering stuff, you could do worse than the Astaro. It's not expensive. It's fair to middling. And if you're looking to buy a throwaway that after a couple of years you could go, well, that was a good idea. You haven't sunk to it. And the support's pretty fair. And the good news is it also filters idiots who download viruses and crap from websites, as opposed to your main chain.
But again, it's designed to be UTM which is designed to be your gateway, designed to be your default gateway, designed to be your single point of contact with the internet. It's not designed to be your MX hub.
No.
It does inline filtering.
If that's what you want, if the brain space of those who are decision makers are, you must have box inline because of firewall. Hmm. Yeah, I've got it like that. How do you think I got mine?
Fine. No, the firewall bit pre-exists. The placement of the diagram to have replicas.
But you're going to talk with pretty much every product there except Eric.
I think there's GFI. We use their software for filter spam and virus filtering.
Yeah.
They make it. Mm-hmm. I've never owned one of these, but I assume just an imitation of software.
Yeah.
And I would say that after having configured mine for about 6 years now, it works great.
How often do you have to configure it? And that's the other thing about spam control is
daily. Yeah, well, like in our case, we decided to set it up such that we don't allow users, or we don't set them up with their own individual quarantines that they can go in and process. It does have the capacity to do that. Like you can have it send your end users a message, say, every day to say, these messages were quarantined, you want to go in and clear them. In our case, we're small enough to decide. We just let the mail administrator decide what spam is.
We definitely had a quarantine.
It offers that. And they sell it as an appliance. They sell it like three ways. You can just buy the software, stick it on a Windows server. You can buy a combination hosted server and your own. So you're sending, the MX way, send it them first. They filter it. You can manage it a little bit, and then it's to your box, and they filter it. Or you can just buy a rack mount box. You stick it in the rack and put that yourself inside your own.
How do you spell it?
Astaro, A-S-T-A-R-O.
You specifically may run into problems with it. They do not even attempt to hide the fact they run them.
Mm-hmm. And they were just purchased by SoFox, so they're now.
Well, see, that was the one that I did see the thing at SoFox under the cover.
Your own plated. But SoFox, at least, is you've got a company that's got a good bar step and an R&D shop. So, yeah, you could do worse. The box when I bought it was, I got a deal for $1,200 for they said they would handle up to 75 users. Based on the kind of traffic I was seeing, you might be able to push that a little higher. How many? They got about two.
It's about 3,000 users.
You got 3,000 users on an Exchange server box?
I see you
backing up slowly.
And it's not going to be a Exchange server box. It's going to be a mini server
box. With 2010.
But I wouldn't call
it. No.
You must have multiple.
This kind of ties into the earlier thing about phishing, because a lot of phishing is spam. Spear phishing, not so much. You got to be a little more socially adept to pull that one.
Well, you have to get the order of the company too.
The organizational, the org chart.
Yeah, if you do it in the wrong order, if you try to spear up, you're not going to be quite as successful.
Or you're going to get fired and wonder why. Somebody told my boss,
okay.
What?
You can just claim your Twitter account. For a few days.
No, I'm going to use the therapy. I'm going to get therapy.
But we digress.
You ready, Chris? Yeah, I've got a crazy question. What do you do get, Sam?
I have an email address.
Post it in just one place on the internet.
Yeah.
Or mail it to anyone else.
Actually,
who might be compromised.
Post the username.
Absolutely. Be a member of a group with 3,000 people, of which one guy posted that address. Is that probably? If you are networked, do you get spam because you're co-partner on the network gets spam?
Well, if some person has you in their address book gets hacked, then you will get spam. Probably from them.
Maybe a spammer is the domain name, address, dimmer, or subdomain.
Well, yeah, there's also dictionary X for spam. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got a catch-all address set on my mail server. Anything at athompson.net gets dropped to a special account if it doesn't already exist somewhere else.
Does it have its own private?
Not quite. No, thanks to great listing, it doesn't trade it. And what I'll see on a regular basis is an email, spam to Adam, spam to Alan, spam to Andrew, like every common combination of first name, every common combination of first initial, last name, every common combination of first name, last initial, just brute force So yeah.
Well, I get those almost every night, and they're you too, I'm sure, Gilbert. And you'll find 3,000, 4,000 names on the list. That's it can really clog up your log files if you let it.
Yep. The weird thing is when you look at it, it comes from different IP addresses. It's all botnets.
Yeah.
You can't even you can't take a look at this and go, oh, that's five from the same IP address you've got. Not in a connect. No, it's a fool's errand. There'd be a thousand IP. There's almost as many IP addresses as there are attacks.
Wait till IPv6 takes off. It'll feel good.
You're gone.
What's a common quantity of spam emails per day?
How many emails do you get in your inbox?
What?
How many emails do you receive?
About one or two, but I get over 50 of the spam.
The standard rule I've heard is take the number of emails you get, multiply by 200, that's how many spams you've got.
Yep. Okay.
A lot of them your server won't even accept because they're so heavily RDL'd that it just won't even take the connection. Then there's about 50 times what you get, which end up in your spam folder because the RBLs haven't caught up with those guys. But they have Viagra in one of the 42 spellings in the head, or Cialis in one of the 42 spellings.
Does anyone know of any that tried
it? It's the quick shift. Gray listings are a really good place to start. It's a pain in the ass to them to mail administrators, but it really is the only tool I found which has a reasonable effectiveness.
I found forces RSM and makes people build the servers.
The hang-up is that gray listing still scrambles a whole bunch of exchange servers.
I said properly configured.
Touché, sir.
In terms of RBLs, the one that I found to be one of the best out there is the Zen list from spamhouse.org.
Yeah.
It's not $1,000, I think it's €130 or something. But yeah.
And yet the bizarre thing is if you sign on for your free trial for that service, and then what you do is put in a whole bunch of IP addresses of people who know are spamming you, they're not on the list. So you wonder if the spammers aren't running these just to screw up the whole RBL process. Or am I just being paranoid?
No, I don't think so.
Don't they hack into the list?
They'll try.
I found an interesting website a long time ago where it said near the bottom there's a link that said if you're a spam bot, click here. And it gave like 50 or 100 generated email addresses and said click here if you'd like more, and it would just go on as long as you wanted.
Yeah, auto generated pages, I think, of these things.
Yeah. That's the weapon of choice to fight back.
So basically do a DOS against crawlers that don't obey robots' attacks. Interesting.
I think the average, though, is still like 97.99% all inbound SMB traffic spam. Like that's average for business.
Depending on who you talk to, those numbers, that's what I say. Take what you get and multiply by 100. That's what people try to say.
So are there any more last questions before we close the table?
I got an answer to your question about hooking up to your machine. I bought one of these things at the Apple store where you can watch from your monitor. But then I found out that I wasn't getting any work done. So I started using it. It's a nice thing to have if you want to record stuff and if your DB set breaks down. But I find that I compartmentalize my work from relaxing, and I can't relax. And it was a big mistake for me. I realized that what I should have done was just when I'm in front of the television, I'm relaxing. When I'm in front of my computer, I try and do some productive, write codes. If I start mixing the two, I don't get anything. So that's sort of word of caution.
I dedicated a machine, not something where you go, ooh, what's happening?
Did you not see our MIT meetings that we had a couple years ago? MIT is what you have.
Yeah.
I've gone on, I've looked at no truck. Like I said, I can go on and watch, but do appreciate some of the awesome people here. Face who's been there for hands.
People here are doing that are running MIT.
However, appears to free. If and well. ATSC finally in Canada.
End of August.
August. This year?
30th of August 2011.
Yeah, 2011.
I was looking at the radio frequencies.
Why would you be bothered by that? Because they're shorting the other.
Shaw Digital Swarthy, yes, one of the advantages of Myth was that you could load up a machine with a log capture cards if you wanted to, or 27 channels simultaneously. Now you need a set-top box per simultaneous channel record watch. And with MTS, they're capped at 3. With Shaw, they don't think they have a cap on it currently. Shaw is in process of from a hybrid HFC model to an all-IPU model. They already started its work in Alberta. So somewhere down the road, there will be a cap on the boxes Shaw can raise as well. ExpressView does not currently have a technical cap, but they won't sell you.
They put in a rent board and one dish before.
Really?
I got three on one dish.
When I talked to him.
In terms of cable, Shaw cable still does the analog
right
up to a certain channel, at which point then you got to get a digital box.
That's it for this podcast. Thanks for listening. For more Mug Meetings summaries or for more information about the Manitoba Unix User Group, check out our website at muug.mb.ca.